Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY Allentown, listener-supported community public radio in the Lehigh Valley. John Pierce along with Ray Schwab. Ray, you are ready to rock, are you?
I'm always ready to rock, John. How about you?
Yes, he is, though you didn't bring your guitar or piano today.
Not this time, not this time.
Well, we're going to be talking about immigration reform, one of the burning issues of our times. This is our topic this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse, and our guests are Dr. Erica Sutherland and Armando Jimenez. Dr. Sutherland is a professor at Muhlenberg College, here to discuss young immigrants, immigration reform, and our nation's future. Erica, I've known you for 18 years.
Just about. I met you in 1995.
That's right. And because of your passion for work with Hispanics in the Lehigh Valley and beyond, it was only a matter of time until we could have you come to WDIY for a discussion on Lehigh Valley Discourse.
So, well, thanks for the invitation.
Welcome to both you and Armando.
Thank you. Thank you,
Armando. This is your first time at WDIY?
Yes, it is.
Okay, found his way up to the third floor. And it's not Erica's first time, though. You've been on the air before.
I've been on a couple times before,
yes,
yeah.
You're used to the microphones. Dr. Sutherland is Associate Professor of Spanish at Muhlenberg College, and she's the Director of Grupo de Apoyo e Integración Hispanoamericano. Ooh, that's a long title.
Most of the time people call it the Grupo de Apoyo, but we want to make
sure it's not the... For an obvious reason. Yeah,
yeah,
that's
exactly
the reason Los Angeles is not Los Angeles de, and right. So, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Dr. Sutherland received her Ph.D. in Spanish Literature from the University of Pennsylvania. She joined Muhlenberg College's Department of Languages, Literatures, and Cultures in 1995, teaching courses in language and especially the literature and cultures of Spain. So you have at least two major interests here, Erica. One is Spain, and when people in this country say, oh, that person is Spanish, it's probably not true, huh? It's probably just Spanish speaking, right?
That's actually a pretty good question. Yeah, no, my academic work is mostly focused on Spain, literatures and cultures of Spain, but my community work is very much around the Latin American community, the Hispanic American community here.
Exactly. And you have studied the relationship between literature and society, and particularly work in 19th century literary and medical images of the female body and gender-based violence. And you have not gotten away from that topic, probably, working with...
No, I still work extensively in that. And right now I'm teaching a course actually really very much focusing on the notions of body and soul.
Erica has also developed service learning courses in translation and interpreting. They seek to leverage the energy brought by students to serve their needs while also serving the Valley's diverse communities of Spanish speakers. Now, Erica, when you say diverse communities of Spanish speakers, how many communities are we talking about here?
Well, like you said, very often when people see someone or hear someone speaking Spanish, they say, oh, they are Spanish. Here in the Valley, we actually have an extraordinarily diverse community, diverse in terms of geography, people coming from South America, Central America, Mexico, the Caribbean, and yes, Spain as well. Not to mention the Portuguese, who, although they don't speak Spanish, they eat Spanish.
Interesting.
The Portuguese restaurants here are as close to the Spanish food as I can get, and I just am madly in love with them. But here in the Lehigh Valley, we have a very old population from Puerto Rico that's been here really since 1898. We also have a very well-entrenched Peruvian community that's been here since the 1950s. More recent communities include Ecuadorians, Colombians, Hondurans, Dominicans, and, of course, Mexicans.
And you've met with them all at one point or another.
With our immigrant support group, the Grupo de Apoyo, we work with all of the different Hispanic communities here. And I've been surprised to find, actually, through my work with the Grupo de Apoyo, that we actually have a small but very active Uruguayan community here. I wouldn't have known that if I weren't working with this organization.
Armando, let's talk a little bit about your background. Originally from where?
I'm originally from Puebla, Mexico. I was brought to this country when I was 2 years old. And when I was 5, I arrived to Pennsylvania and I've been here ever since.
So all of your education has been here in Pennsylvania?
Yes, specifically Allentown, yeah.
And what schools?
Dodd Elementary, South Mountain Middle School, and Lewis E. Durif High School.
Durif High School, all right. And right now, what is your connection with Dr. Sutherland?
Well, it all began in 2010 when immigration reform was about to happen. And due to my status, because I was here without papers, because I was brought to this country without going through the checkpoints illegally through the border. And we were pushing hard for immigration reform. And I forget who I got in contact with, but I was like, who do I speak to help out so I could do something about it? And automatically they said Erica Sutherland.
Was that at high school that you asked?
No, I was out of high school. I graduated in 2005. I couldn't go to college because I had to pay out-of-state tuition because I didn't have a Social Security card. So I've just been working in regular jobs. But it was like the frustration of not being able to do something. I wanted to be active to play a role in immigration reform. And that's how I got in contact with Erica Sutherland.
And Armando, I have to say, it was you who put us in contact with some of the bigger Dreamer groups, both in Philadelphia and on a national level. And in large part, because of your connections, we've become stronger in a regional and national level.
What are the Dreamer groups?
The Dreamers is the Dream is an acronym for Development Relief Education for Alien Minors. It's basically a bill in Congress that was introduced all the way back in 2001. It's a bill saying that if you were brought to this country as a child, you graduated high school, you're a good moral, have good moral citizenship, basically stay out of the law, you know, don't break the rules. And if you plan on going to college for 2 years or enlisting in the military for at least 2 years, you're put on a path to citizenship. And basically, ever since we've been called Dreamers because we benefit from this bill that's been in Congress since 2001. It's now 2013, and still it hasn't passed.
It has lingered in Congress.
Yes.
Well, it was presented formally in 2009 and again in 2011, but never actually even came up for a vote. However, last summer, President Obama announced, summer of 2012, President Obama announced a deferred action for childhood arrivals, also called DACA, which is sort of like a Dream Act light in that there are some provisions specifically geared at young people, again, people who arrived in the country as minor children. The cutoff is you have to have arrived in the country before turning 16. And you have to have been in the country for at least 5 years before you can apply for this. And you cannot be older than 30. So with the new DACA, suddenly for the first time ever, and by executive order rather than by legislation, young immigrants who were brought in either legally or illegally, but who ended up staying in an undocumented status, now have the opportunity to have a 2-year work permit, a 2-year protection from deportation, and 2-year access to education and to all of the benefits of being a permanent resident without actually being a permanent resident. It is a 2-year protected status that is infinitely renewable.
And this is the law of the land right now?
It's the law of the land as we speak.
By executive order.
By executive order.
Armando, are you in this group of people who have the 2-year renewable?
Yes. I applied last year around the same time, like October. And in 3 months, I was granted deferred action. And now I'm protected from deportation. But it's tricky because you're legally here, but you still can't do things like... You can't travel outside the country. I haven't seen my grandparents for 18 years. My mom hasn't seen her parents for 18 years, almost 19. And we can't apply for certain jobs that require citizenship. Like if I want to join the military, I can't join the military. And it's something that I've been wanting to do since I was in junior high. I was in the Air Force Junior ROTC in high school. And
so they accepted you into that group?
Yes, because it was high school and it was like a academy type of stuff. And I was very good at it and I fell in love with the whole idea of joining the military. But as soon as I graduated, of course, I didn't even try because I know I wasn't going to be accepted.
This is Armando Jimenez speaking, and he is our guest along with Dr. Erica Sutherland. And we're speaking about young immigrants, immigration reform, and our nation's future.
Ray? Now, we'd like to let the listeners know if you have any questions or comments on tonight's topic, you could give us a call at 610-758-8810. Again, that's 610-758-8810. Now, Erica, I'm interested. How did you become involved in this issue of immigration reform?
Well, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and in Washington, D.C., I was always surrounded by people speaking many languages and coming to the table with lots of different perspectives and lots of different ideas. And I grew up believing that this is the way the world worked. When I actually moved out on my own and realized the world isn't quite so understanding and isn't quite so...
open.
Well, we can put it that way, sure. I was really startled to find out that people are afraid of people who speak a different language or who have a different color skin or who eat different kinds of food. And I found that really surprising. And in my first job, my first academic job was up at Marywood College in Scranton. And that coincided with the first ever immigration raid in Northeast Pennsylvania. And the conditions of that raid were fairly appalling. Some 165 men were put on an airplane at 7 in the morning, an airplane to El Paso. And on the plane ride down to El Paso, they found out they had about a dozen Puerto Ricans on the plane. Puerto Ricans, of course, are U.S. citizens. In addition to which, there were about a dozen other people who were who had immigration applications pending, so they were not deportable. And yet, the government hadn't stopped to figure that out before sending them to El Paso. And the seed of an activist in me started sprouting. And over the following years, I realized that this is an issue of social justice, of human rights, that is something that defies logic that anyone wouldn't be standing up to fight for the weakest among us who actually do the hardest jobs against the worst circumstances. And again, that was back in 1994 when the immigration raid at Robeson's meatpacking plant happened. And I've never really turned back. And I feel that I'm doing the right thing. I feel that I'm working on behalf of those who need help. And I know that some people would say, well, are you betraying your country by doing this? To which I would answer, no, we are a country born of immigrants, and for immigrants. And therefore, I'm just continuing a very proud tradition of our nation.
Well said. Ray, where do your ancestors come from?
Well, I have ancestors from my father's side who were German and Italian, and then also on my mother's side who were primarily German. But we've also been in the United States for a very long time, I think since the colonial days. So,
all right. And mine come from the British Isles, and I'm 10th generation on one side and 11th generation on the other. So ours have been here a very long time also. But we always have to remember that we went back to some other land at some point. And Erica, how about you?
Well, on my father's side, the Sutherland side, they came back a long time ago into the 18th century. And that they're coming from Scotland. My mother's side, Irish side, Irish and Welsh, but the Irish part of the family came back in the 1890s, so they're much more recent. I do want to point out when we talk about our ancestors who came over, and I've certainly heard people say, well, my great-grandparents came over legally. That's not actually true because there simply were no laws up until the 1920s regarding who could come in. The only policies that were in place had to do with Asians on the Pacific Coast coming in as bonded labor versus contract labor and issues about health. There were checks to make sure the people coming in through Ellis Island were healthy, but there were no quotas and there were no laws and there were no passports until the 1920s.
That's pretty late.
It is pretty late.
To have law. But that was right at the time that we were also giving women the vote in this country.
There's a lot of progress going on.
Don't know if there's any connection there. When we speak about immigration as an issue today, as a problem today, it seems to me almost certainly we think of our southern border. We think about Mexico, Central America. So the question is immigration completely a Hispanic issue?
It is absolutely not a Hispanic issue. The largest number of undocumented immigrants are indeed Hispanic, in fact, largely from Mexico, which makes sense. It's a very large country, and it's to our immediate southern border. There's a perfectly logical reason why we have those numbers. I should point out that into the 1980s, the second largest number of undocumented immigrants in the country were from Canada, something that we don't often think about. But up until That's the right. 1980s, that was the case. Is it entirely a Hispanic issue? No. In terms of the numbers, that's the single biggest group, absolutely, both of immigrants and undocumented immigrants. But immigration is a worldwide issue. People migrate to where there are jobs, and they migrate away from where there are not jobs and where there is injustice. Here in the United States, we have very solid laws to protect human rights and human dignity. Plus, we have work. Immigrants come here to work, and they find work.
And you mentioned before, very often they take jobs that are the most taxing physically. They're long work days. It's seasonal work. In many cases, people have to pick up and move after the growing season is over if they're working in agriculture.
Well, John, I do want to jump in and say that we're talking about immigrants writ large, because when we talk about immigration reform, we're not just talking about undocumented immigrants, but immigration and immigrants in general. Of this past year's Nobel Prize winners, there were 9 American Prize winners, 4 of whom were immigrants. So we really are talking about a phenomenon that reaches all over society. Of the largest businesses in the country, again, many of them are founded by immigrants or sons of immigrants, sons or daughters of immigrants. So when we're looking at immigration reform, I really want to be clear that we're not just talking about undocumented immigration, but immigration all over. Anyone who has come from someplace else, in Hispanic families, that's really almost any family, has, even if they are fully documented, fully legal, you know someone. You've got a cousin, you've got a neighbor, there's someone that who has had encounters with the immigration system. And again, whether it's legal immigration or illegal immigration, the system is broken and really needs a reform.
All right. When we come back from our break, which we're going to take right now, I'm going to ask you, Erica, why the issue of immigration is important to people who are documented. I thought it was merely an issue of those who don't have official papers. Lehigh Valley Discourse, John Pierce, along with Ray Schwab, and we'll be back in 60 seconds.
WDIY is proud to partner with the Seed Farm, presenting Lehigh Valley Harvest in collaboration with Buy Fresh, Buy Local on Sunday, October 27th at the Allentown Brew Works from 1 to 4 p.m. Tickets are available for the Bon Appetit VIP hour from noon to 1. Restaurants, farms, wineries, breweries, and other local food providers give participants the opportunity to taste the Valley's cuisine. For information, 610-391-9583 or theseedfarm.org.
Raymundo Schwab and Don Juan with you here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. How do you like that handle, Ray?
I think I'm going to have to start going with that.
Raymundo. I think you could use that in your musical gigs.
Yeah, I think so. Give me a little flavor.
We are talking about the issue of immigration, particularly young immigrants, immigration reform, and our nation's future. We're talking with Dr. Erica Sutherland of Muhlenberg College about comprehensive immigration reform. And Erica, you said that this touches not only people who are undocumented, but also those who came legally. Why?
Those who came legally and those who would like to come legally. The way people come into the country through the visa system is either through a family-based visa or a work-based visa. And right now there's tremendous backlogs on the visa system, so that even if you are approved for a visa, you still have to wait for a visa to become available. And depending on the country from which you're coming, that wait can be a long time. For example, a wife, a husband, or a minor child may have to wait up to 7 years, depending on the country they're coming from. And once the relationship gets a little bit more distant, for example, an older child or an older parent, the waits, for example, from the Philippines right now, for a U.S. citizen requesting a parent, for example, coming in from the Philippines, that could be a 17-year wait. And that's the kind of wait that just doesn't make sense. It's not humane. It all but cuts off the possibility of coming in legally or coming in at all. While a person is waiting for a visa to become available, no visas are available for that person. So even if they're waiting for a green card visa, a visa to come in to pick up a green card, they will not be conceded a tourist visa in the meantime, because the assumption is that they'll jump the visa and not stay around for the visa that's actually waiting for them. So it's really a very sad situation. I could actually speak to my husband, who is a naturalized citizen. And
he's from where?
He's from Panama, but he's now a U.S. citizen and became a U.S. citizen in 1994, a year before I met him. And when he became a citizen, he petitioned for his daughters, who at that point were young. And as they were waiting for the visa to become available, one of them aged out and turned 21, so had to go to the back of a different line for adult children. And so it was the second daughter who was able to come in first, and the first daughter ended up waiting another 2 or 3 years before she was able to come in. And we think about what we're asking people to do to stay separated as a family, and this is legal immigration. It's a system that simply doesn't work. And Panama by no means has the worst lines. Mexico and the Philippines and to a lesser extent India have very much the longest lines. Now, for work visas, there are quotas that are set up. There are caps that are set up for different categories of work visas. And again, the U.S. industry, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, for example, has said again and again, there simply are not enough visas available to accommodate the need. To fill the need, rather, of workers that U.S. companies are looking for. This particularly hits hard in the agricultural sector and in the high-tech sector, the STEM, the science, technology, engineering, and medicine sectors. Those are the two areas where you have the highest demand and the lowest percentage of visas available.
Is it true that, as far as the agricultural work is concerned, that people who are already established in the United States do not want to do that kind of work? That they're, if we were to say no immigrants without legal papers are going to work in agriculture, that we wouldn't have enough agricultural workers?
I think there have been a fair number of studies out there that have indicated that the different conditions that people are looking for when they look for a job would include job security, salary, working conditions. And they have found that even if you raise the salary of agricultural work to a living wage, what we would call a living wage, there still would not be people willing to work in those fields simply because the conditions are so difficult. It's difficult. If you want to have beautiful hand-picked fruit, you need a hand to pick that fruit. And many people are just not willing to do that kind of very hard work.
And there have been efforts along the way from the president or from Congress through the years to punish employers who employ people who do not have their documents.
Well, the law of the land is an employer must require permission, work permits of their employees. And should an employer be found to be hiring people without permits, there actually are significant sanctions, both financial and legal sanctions against the companies. And those sanctions are often brought to bear. More often, it's the employees who are punished and not so much the companies.
I've heard that it's really a question of the oversight, that we don't have the staff power to enforce these laws very much.
That may be the case. I would argue that it's much more likely a question of not wanting to enforce those laws, that a workforce that is in a vulnerable position is a workforce that some large corporations particularly would prefer to have, that makes for a much more malleable employee, an employee who's much less likely to complain about working conditions, about payment conditions. And in fact, it's interesting, the state of Pennsylvania, like virtually every other state in the country, has their Board of Labor that specifically seeks to address any complaint of non-payment or abuse of working conditions, and on the forms, on the applications to denounce, to complain about unpayment, for example, or abuse of working conditions, there is no mention whatsoever about the immigration status or Social Security number of the employees, strictly because it is in the state, it is in the country's interest that working conditions be safe and fair for all workers. A day worked should be a day paid. A day worked should always be a safe day. And so it's something that seemed to be in the common interest, the common good, that immigration issues be kept off the table when we're talking about worker safeties. And again, that's a kind of funny irony when we talk about where the enforcement is coming in. Honestly, I think it's really wonderful that we do worry about the safety of the workers and that we do worry about the fact that they should get paid. But yeah, there are definitely sanctions for employers who don't treat their workers well.
And sometimes people with political aspirations get caught by when they do background checks, finding out that they had a nanny who was not here legally and they never paid taxes on the wages and gardeners
correct.
And whoever it might be.
That's correct. There is actually a way of paying your nanny, even if your nanny is undocumented, if your nanny has a taxpayer identification number, which is something we encourage every immigrant here who is unable to get a Social Security. We encourage those immigrants to get a taxpayer ID number so that at least those people are able to pay their taxes and be on the books as doing everything that they could do within the law as the law pertains to them to stake their claim in the United States, to show that they're here and that they're doing whatever they can do to be doing the right thing.
Are you saying that people without proper documents to be here still can have a tax
Absolutely.
ID number?
In fact, the tax ID number is not for anyone who is eligible for a Social Security number.
All right. It's a parallel system to the Social Security
exactly.
card.
It directly connected to the IRS, not to the Social Security Administration. Mm-hmm.
And we'd like to remind the listeners, if you have any questions for Erica or Armando on tonight's topic, immigration reform, you could give us a call at 610-758-8810.
What is it about the current climate that makes the push for immigration reform possible at this point?
Well, we've just gotten off the government shutdown, the budget crisis and the government shutdown. And we'd like to note that that was really a sad example of government not working together. But immigration reform is one issue on which the government has worked together in the past. We have a bipartisan bill that came out of the Senate. Now there's a Democratic bill that's coming out of the House, but it has the potential of being a bipartisan bill. We'd actually really like to encourage some of the more moderate Republicans, some of the Republicans who've expressed interest in the issue and have certainly expressed support. We'll speak and most directly to Charlie Dent right now here in our in our area, who has come out in support of different aspects of immigration reform, not in the terms of comprehensive immigration reform. But we'd really like to say this is a time if we can get Republicans to make some common sense decisions and to work towards comprehensive immigration reform, I think this is a really good time where the government can redeem itself by saying, okay, maybe we messed up on this budget thing and maybe we weren't looking at the best interest of the country with the budget shutdown. On the other hand, immigration reform, there are enough components of immigration reform that we can all agree on as a place to move forward and show the country that Congress is working for and with us.
May it be so. Yesterday in the news, Speaker of the House John Boehner came out saying that immigration reform is one of the most important issues before the group. I just wonder now with your comments, Erica, whether he's doing that in part because this is a place where finally congressmen and women can come together and have some agreement between Democrats and Republicans.
I think politicians are above all are politicians, and it's a political thing to do. I think it's the right time. Survey after survey across the nation has shown that we believe in major components of comprehensive immigration reform. We believe, for example, that the young people who were brought in as children, they shouldn't be held accountable for their undocumented status. It makes sense that they be given a path, a clear path, to citizenship. There are other components. Most people will agree when they hear about the awful visa backlog, so that's just not right, that there needs to be some kind of a change. When people hear about the extraordinary fees associated with immigration proceedings, most people will agree that those are unreasonable, out-of-control fees.
What are some of the figures that you've seen?
Well, for citizenship, it's nearly $1,000 per person. To apply for a husband or a wife, again, about $900 a person. And this is just for one application. It's a multi-step process. In the past, applications often included children, minor children, as part of a single application. Now every single person gets has to be paid for separately. For DACA, deferred action, it's nearly $500 for the application. And again, that needs to be renewed every 2 years. And we're not talking about a wealthy community. We're talking about a hardworking community. And in terms of DACA, we're talking about young people. And $500 is a lot of money.
Armando Jimenez is with us this evening also. And Armando, what kind of work have your parents been doing all these years? First of all, how long have they been in the United States?
Well, my mom has been here for, I'm 27, and I was brought here when I was two, so she's been here 25 years. And the work that she's done mostly is sewing in sewing factories. It's a very hard work that doesn't pay like it used to pay. And
she get paid by the piece?
No, it's hourly.
It's hourly.
And it's minimum wage. They do not want to pay more because, you know, as many sewing factories have been shipped over to China, those jobs don't pay like they used to pay. But yeah, it's very hard to come up with money as a working immigrant community, because most jobs that we can get, we have to work for long hours to just make enough to pay the bills and such.
Right. What about your father?
My father has been here. He's in Mexico now. He was actually deported 2 years ago. I believe it's still unclear why he was deported, but we think it was because driving under the influence of alcohol. It's a tricky situation because we're all humans and nobody's perfect. And for something like that, you shouldn't be deported to a country that you haven't been there for years.
Which shows that the undocumented just cannot slip up in any way.
Exactly.
Or they're in great danger.
That's actually one of the reasons why one of the things that our Grupo de Apoyo does is really encourage green card holders to apply for citizenship. And we work with different community organizations to prepare people to take the citizenship, the naturalization exam. It's very important because, as you very well put it, as long in the climate that we have right now, almost anything that an immigrant does, again, be it an undocumented immigrant or even a green card holder, it doesn't take much to lose that status.
Armando, what is your status as far? You have this 2-year renewable card. What's it called?
It's called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It was the first one to use it was a singer from the Beatles. I think it was John Lennon. I don't remember, but that was the first time it was ever used. So it's interesting because it's already been out there for a long time, and we knew it was out there, and we had to push Obama, President Obama, to issue it because it's something that has existed for many years and people have been granted deferred action.
Do you have a pathway to become a green card holder yourself?
No. I like to think of it like I'm legally here. I'm here legally, but I'm still illegal. What I mean by that is that I'm only allowed to work here. And I have the paper, and actually it says this does not give you any kind of immigration status. It gives you permission to work.
So it's so that your employer would not have any problems with employing you.
Yes, that, and I cannot be deported. And that's all it is. It's like the very bare minimum. It's not green card. It's not citizenship at all. And it's not TPS.
That's temporary protected status. And that's a special status. It's very much like deferred action that's been granted to people from different places where there have been natural disasters, for example, or civil wars. In Central America, Hondurans have been granted TPS after Hurricane Mitch. There was an earthquake in El Salvador, and many Salvadorans got TPS. And much like deferred action, it does not involve a path towards a green card. It's an indefinite status, but it can be indefinitely renewed. Every 2 years, it can be renewed.
I would also like to add, unless a new president comes along and likes to cancel it, he could do that too. So it's
because it is by executive order.
It's not
by the Congress.
Exactly.
Therefore, it could be overturned by another president coming in.
Yeah. So if a new president comes along and he wants to take it out of the table, then I could be deported tomorrow, the very next day.
Do you have brothers and sisters here?
Yes. I have another brother who's in the same situation as I am. He's a year older than me, and I have a younger brother who's 18, and he was actually born in this country. So it's interesting to have mixed status families, and it's known all across the U.S. that there's mixed statuses. You have siblings that are citizens and others that are not, and you have parents that are citizens. And because of the broken immigration system, we can't do nothing about it. Families are being torn apart every day. 1,100 families, people, are deported every single day. And it's like the media doesn't want to show that ugly part of immigration. That, for example, like a year ago, I was waked up in the middle of the night. My mom was waking me up, and she said, your brother's been stopped by the police, and he's harassing him. He's telling him that where's his social security card, and he wants to know if he's here legally. And I believe that in Allentown, policemen are not supposed to do immigration
checks.
Yeah. And the cop took it upon him to harass my brother. So for like 2 hours, 3 hours, we didn't know if I was going to see my brother the next day. And that's just one story. I mean, people do get torn apart. And it's something that we had to live. We live every day. We just don't know in a certainty. Like I said, I'm protected from deportation, but my mom, she still could be deported.
But you cannot go and visit your father in Mexico.
No, I cannot go visit my father.
And he probably cannot come back here.
He can't. It's most certainly over for him to try to come here legally.
Now, can you explain some of the differences a little more specifically between what you've experienced with your status and your younger brother's status who was born here?
For me, it's been very difficult because I was here since I was 2 years old, and I always knew that I was here without papers. My brother, on the other hand, he has assimilated completely into America. He takes it for granted too. It's interesting and frustrating to see the two sides.
Well, are you in more danger of being deported than he is? Your younger brother.
My younger brother.
Who was born here.
More in danger of being deported?
Yeah, you can't deport a U.S. citizen.
Yeah. Right.
So the fact that he was born here of undocumented parents, he is a U.S. citizen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He could be the next president of the United States.
But, I mean, as you explained earlier, you would have had trouble applying to college because of not having a social security card. Are there any other differences that you would experience day to day or through work?
It's like every day you're reminded that until deferred actions, like every day you're reminded that you don't have papers, and it could be anything.
So it was never really anything hanging over your brother's head. He's just sort of gone along his way.
Yes. This one time I had to return a pair of jeans and I didn't have an ID card, and I brought along my passport, and the cash register was looking at me like, what is this? I'm like, I don't have anything else but my passport from Mexico. And I spent like 15 minutes while she got her manager to try to figure out how to type it into the computer system. So it's like every single day was one thing. If it wasn't one thing, it was another thing. And also driving, I had to drive because in Allentown, you can't get nowhere without driving. You're waiting for hours for the buses. So being afraid of the cops, of getting pulled over, was something that
So it can range from things as far as future plans in college to driving to even just mundane things like returning a pair of jeans.
Yes, yes. And
thank you, Armando. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse, and you're hearing from Armando Jimenez and Dr. Erica Sutherland on the topic of young immigrants, immigration reform, and our nation's future. Lehigh Valley Discourse, Raimundo and Don Juan return in 60 seconds.
You're listening to WDIY, Community Public Radio for the Lehigh Valley. If you appreciate and value the programming we provide, including NPR's in-depth news coverage, our local public affairs programs, and the diverse mix of music we broadcast each day, please consider becoming a member. Membership is our most important source of revenue. We can't do it without you. You can make a secure donation online at wdiy.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Young immigrants, immigration reform, and our country's future. This is our topic this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. John Pierce and Ray Schwab, your hosts. And as our guests, Dr. Erica Sutherland, professor of Spanish at Muhlenberg College, and Armando Jimenez, a Lehigh Valley resident for the past 25 years.
25 years.
Your mother came immediately to the Lehigh Valley?
No, first we were in Los Angeles, and we had a crazy uncle who doesn't have a crazy uncle in the family, who was living all by himself.
Good question. a hermit.
He was living all alone in Pennsylvania. He would go anywhere to find work, and he told my family that there's work in Pennsylvania. So like that, we just packed up and drove all across.
I thought that Mexicans finding Los Angeles would just say, this is my country. This is it. I need to stay here because you have all kinds of services, huh? In Spanish,
yes.
The food.
My mom actually tells me that she was thinking that she wasn't come to like all Anglo-Saxon culture, English. And when she came here, everybody spoke Spanish and everybody.
You're talking about the Lehigh Valley now?
No,
Los Angeles.
Yeah, Los Angeles. Yeah, so she was surprised. She's like, I thought we were coming to Gringolandia.
haven't we crossed the border yet? She said.
But yeah, yeah.
So now we have Hispanics all over the country, Erica. We have big pockets of Hispanics in places like Denver and Chicago. In fact, I've heard that when they run ads, now that television and radio is so big in Hispanics, in sports, and we love hearing the announcers on soccer shout, goal! do the Mexican announcers do that?
Oh, they have to, they don't get the job. You have to say, yeah.
That would be like one of our baseball announcers saying, and it's a home run.
Yeah.
You just can't do that.
You can't do that.
But, Ray, my favorite cuisine of all those that I've tried, Mexican.
Now, why is that, John?
Love it. Love it. I think it's the spices, and that comes from the Indian background. And I mean, how can you explain why you like a certain...
Well, what's your favorite dish?
So great to me. Tamales.
Okay.
Tamales.
We're coming up on tamale season. With the Day of the Dead that happens next week, tamales are a huge component of that. And then, of course, Christmas isn't Christmas without tamales.
Oh, all right.
Monday night in my house, we're having a tamalada.
Oh, and Raimundo and I are invited. Did I hear
that
properly?
Absolutely.
the Day of the Dead. Let's talk a little bit about that. Do you? It's the 2nd of November every year. Dr. Sutherland has a big. What do we say?
Well, in Spanish, it would be una ofrenda, offering, but in English, we'd probably call it an altar.
An altar. It's something that happens at the chapel at Muhlenberg College, and everybody's welcome to go over and take a look at this. It is unique. I mean, we don't have anything like that in our country. Now, I've asked Mexican people, is this widespread in Mexico? Does every family have an altar? What's your situation now that you're living in the Lehigh Valley?
Yes. My mom always tells me that the Day of the Dead for Mexican people is taken a little bit more serious here. And I do believe it, too, because over here it seems to only be candy and candy.
And it's taken more seriously where?
In Mexico. The reason I say that is because you're honoring your dead. You're remembering, and it's not so much sadness and depression, because when somebody thinks of the dead, it's like taboo. But in Mexico, it's thought of, you're celebrating your family that passed away, and you're remembering them, and you're like a party, like you're happy that they were alive, and this is what they contributed to the family. For my mom, she has a brother that passed away, and she would put like the things that he liked the most, like if they like preferred Pepsi versus Coke, something that reminds that they like
a soccer ball, maybe.
Yeah, because it's believed that they come back, and you always want to give them something that they enjoyed when they were alive.
Mm-hmm. And so you set up an altar at home.
Yes.
And what we would see on the altar are some of these objects that the person enjoyed in life.
Yes.
Picture of the person?
Yes. Too? The picture of them. Flowers. There's a famous flower called...
Cempasúchil. we also call it a marigold in English. But cempasúchil is the Mexican marigold with a very pungent smell and the distinctive orange, yellow-orange color. And the smell is supposed to guide the dead back, say, this is the day to come back. Because few people will say a marigold smells good, but it definitely smells distinctive. And so when you have hundreds of them lined up, it's the signal that it's time to come back. I should say the Day of Dead is really an interesting cultural phenomenon, because for one day out of the year, you can wallow in the memories of a lost loved one. And you can really relive and enjoy the memories and cry if you need to cry, because there is a little bit of all of that. But that frees you up for 364 days of the year to live your own life without being tied down, weighed down by your grief, because you are dedicating 100% of yourself one day to the memory of those who've gone before.
That's well said. I like the custom also, and the fact that there's joy as well as sadness.
Absolutely.
With thinking about those who have passed on before us. So you are all invited to the Muhlenberg College Chapel, and that will be ready when?
We'll be building it Wednesday evening, so from Thursday next week on. That's Thursday the 31st on through Sunday the 3rd. We have the altar up, and people are welcome not just to visit it, but to actually leave photos, flowers, food in memory of loved ones. By Sunday, there's actually quite a bit of food on the altar.
And there are colorful streamers also.
Streamers. It's papel picado, really beautifully hand-cut tissue paper designs, and it's a highly symbolic thing. They're beautiful to start with, but also they really represent just how beautiful and yet fragile life is. So these are things that are created for one day out of the year, knowing full well that they won't last a week out with the wind and the rain. Now, at Muhlenberg College, we do it in the chapel, so we don't have wind and rain. So they've lasted a little bit longer. But again, they're made with love and carefully preserved from year to year.
Armando, have you seen this display in other years at Muhlenberg College?
No,
all right.
I haven't.
This year, obligatory, my friend.
Okay.
All right, obligatorio, huh?
Yes, all right.
It is the creation of Dr. Sutherland. Without her, this wouldn't exist.
And many community members. I definitely don't do it by myself. It's a collaborative effort.
Now, I'm interested, where do local politicians fall on immigration reform?
Well, just last week, Easton Mayor Sal Panto came out to encourage our local legislators to support comprehensive immigration reform. Ed Pawlowski has been very supportive of comprehensive immigration reform. Now, these are local legislators at the national level. Charlie Dent has come out in support of different components of immigration reform, but has still on the fence about comprehensive immigration reform. We'd very much like to encourage him to move away from piecemeal immigration reform and into comprehensive immigration reform to get the whole package done.
Well, Erica, does everybody agree on what the term comprehensive immigration reform means? It's a fine-sounding phrase, but...
I think that the term comprehensive immigration reform is held up in opposition to piecemeal immigration reform. And there is not widespread, there is not full agreement on what the different components would be that go into comprehensive immigration reform. What we'd like to say is what's important is that reform be viewed as a package, because if you fix one part of the package but don't fix other parts of the package, you end up with bad feelings. In fact, back in 1986, where there was another immigration reform, only parts of the reform were actually implemented, and that includes the amnesty provision for immigrants who were here in 1986 and who fulfilled certain characteristics. There's actually quite a bit of bitterness and anger that you can hear when politicians speak of the 1986 immigration reform because only part of it was ever implemented. And what we'd like to do is to see an immigration reform that is comprehensive, that deals with the visa situation, that deals with the presence of 11 million undocumented immigrants here in the country, that deals with border security. These are all things that are significant issues and that the government needs to deal with. But it just makes sense for it to be dealt with in a comprehensive, unified way.
So those politicians who are supporting a piecemeal immigration reform, what is that they're not in, supporting that would be supported in a comprehensive immigration?
Well, I would argue that once you break the bill up into component pieces, anything can happen. And most importantly, nothing can happen. And the time is now to have reform. The time is now to implement meaningful, comprehensive, common sense immigration reform. And once you start looking at the little different pieces, those can be debated and haggled away to nothingness. But if you keep it as a set package, then you can actually work out with something that has meaningful change.
Ray, what's our phone number in case somebody would like to join us in our remaining moments?
Well, yeah, we're in the closing stretch of the show tonight, but it's not too late if you have any questions or comments for Erica or Armando. Our number is 610-758-8810. Again, 610-758-8810.
Erica, why should the taxpayers of the United States put up money for people who came here illegally and become a drain on the school systems, on the hospitals particularly? What do we owe people who have come here illegally?
Well, I would say that what we owe is what we get. The immigrants who are in this country working, by and large, pay taxes and pay into the Social Security Fund and never get any of that back. Because as they're working, anyone who's paid with a check is paying taxes and is contributing to Social Security. Immigrants pay taxes in the form of sales tax. Immigrants pay taxes in the form of residence taxes. Here in Allentown, for example, the single biggest number of people who own houses are immigrants, are foreign-born. There's a much higher percentage. I think it's 56% and I'm winging this on the statistics, but it's something like 56% of foreign-born people in the Lehigh Valley, in Allentown specifically, own their houses, compared with 48% of native-born Allentonians who own their houses. Immigrants are here to contribute to the community, to improve communities by building businesses, setting roots. And so when we talk about schools perhaps having more children than they would if there weren't immigrant children, that is more than compensated by the contributions that businesses, small businesses, employers, and those who are paying the myriad of taxes that we don't necessarily think of as taxes, but are very much present. There are all kinds of statistics about, certainly are different studies out there showing what financial plus and minuses there are. And by virtually any agreement, any formal study has shown that immigrants are less of a burden than they are contributing members of this. Now, my answers might be different if we were down on the border, but here in the Lehigh Valley, we're nowhere near the border. And so the contributions of immigrants far outweigh any drain that they represent.
Yes, a few of the hot spots have been Arizona, California, Georgia, a little bit to my surprise. But they also passed a fairly strict law similar to that in Arizona, where a person who is suspected of, and this usually means who looks Hispanic, could be stopped by the police and ask for papers, even though the person has done nothing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to read from what Dr. Sutherland gave us in preparation for our interview today. She has recently been awarded a grant to help develop and coordinate service learning opportunities in the Spanish programs across the six-college consortium of the Lehigh Valley, which is called ELVAIC, the Lehigh Valley Association of Independent Colleges, and they include DeSales University, Cedar Crest College, Muhlenberg College, Lehigh University, Moravian College, and Lafayette College. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is going to be?
Sure. This is actually very exciting, and we're just on the verge of getting in applications to take part as individual professors in this grant process. But as a Spanish professor, changing hats a little bit from community activist to college professor, we see the Hispanic community here as a tremendous resource for our students, and we would like to have the community see our students as a tremendous resource for them. So service learning is that meshing of the academic experience with work out in the community so that students are giving what they're getting. And what we're looking to do is to introduce the notion of service learning across the six universities, and in doing so, A, create more and better opportunities for students and more and better opportunities for community organizations to coordinate, because it's hard for a community organization to say no to volunteers. On the other hand, it's much better if volunteers are coordinated in some way and there's some cohesive notion. It's sort of like comprehensive curricular reform, we could call it, as opposed to comprehensive immigration reform.
Well, and the relationship between students and the community is a very going thing right now.
It's
all
huge.
Across the country.
It's huge.
It's something that when I was in college way back when, Ray, we're talking the 1960s, didn't have any of that. We were on a campus, it was in a bubble, and we really didn't have anything to do with the community where the college was located. So this is good. And I must say, Erica, you are the ideal person to head a program like that, because I've seen through the years your passion for working with the community, and particularly with Hispanic people.
Well, so. Muhlenberg College has a Center for Civic Engagement and Community Service, and I have to say that center has been instrumental in training me to think about service learning as an institutional system, and it was really based on work that I've done with their center that has both trained me to feel like I can work to coordinate the six different universities and the communities that we serve. And so I have to say, again, it's a collaborative effort.
And best wishes in the future.
Many thank you.
With this very important work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Armando Jimenez and Dr. Erica Sutherland have been our guests tonight on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Raimundo, we're about to leave, and we want to invite our listeners to
be gentle with your neighbors.
That's all for Lehigh Valley Discourse for now. Thanks for listening.